This event took place 25 years ago, so I apologize in advance if it's not as detailed as you like. I want to stay as true to the memory as possible and only share what I remember. If there are any questions or comments which trigger more details, I would gladly flesh it out a bit. I was 7 and my younger sister was 5, and we disembarked for the school bus hand in hand, excited about our first week of school, ready to tell Mom all about it. We rounded the corner for home and saw that there was no car in the driveway. Little sister was happily chatting about her teacher, new friends, and the playground, but I felt unsettled. Why was Mom gone? Mom was always waiting for us, usually with chopped fruit or veggies. She was ahead of the curve on that. The no junk food rule embarrassed me as a kid, but I'm so grateful for that now. Well, maybe just the car was gone. Silly thought, but not everyone's a genius when they're only 7. As we reached the intersection of the porch and driveway, I knew the car was gone because Mom was gone, because the front door was shut. We weren't latchkey kids, although that was quite normal in our neighborhood, but I did have a house key, just in case. I'd wondered what our parents had meant, but this must be the case. I released my little sister's hand and knelt to fish the key out of the bottom pouch of my backpack. I was a little nervous, but proud I'd remembered, and when I rose to unlock the door, I froze. Looking down on us from inside the house was a figure dressed head to toe in black. To my mind now, this camouflage was so complete that there wasn't anything revealed around the eyes to indicate this person's race. I had stopped with the key in my hand, and although I had no intention of getting it now, the figure shook its head back and forth. I dropped the key and urged my little sister off the porch. I was at a loss of what to do. So I led her to the side yard where we had a tire swing and a rope swing and told her we would wait for Mom. This had not been part of a just-in-case conversation. When I folded myself into the tire swing, I realized I'd wet my pants. Little sister asked me what was wrong, and lying was never my strong point, so I told her someone was in the house. She looked puzzled and said, "It's just Daddy's friend." I asked her how she knew, and she answered that she just did. I told her we would wait for Mom anyways. I don't know how long we waited. I was frightened, hungry, and uncomfortable in my wet pants. Whoever was in the house left from the back door because after some time, my dog darted around the house and happily greeted us. The fence was being redone in the back, and everyone who lived in our house knew to put him on a chain rather than let him run freely and escape through the gaps. Upon Sonny's arrival, little sister was ready to go in, and I was not. We argued in the way kids do, exchanging witty insults such as dum-dum and stupid-head, but I was able to win the battle due to the merit of my age. Mom finally pulled into the driveway, and Sonny and I beelined for her. I had given in to the tears I'd been repressing, and the only thing that shocked me out of my hysterics was Mom urging me to come into the house. I managed to tell her about the man in black, and little sister chimed in with Daddy's friend, and then Mom ushered us into the car, even Sonny, and drove a few blocks to her friend's house. The police were called, we were questioned together and separately, and were left with Mom's friend while she and the officers walked through the house. There had been a break-in focused on the basement, Dad's territory, and my parents' bedroom. If anything was gone, Mom didn't know what it was, and Dad feigned innocence in relation to his friend. Nothing like this has ever happened again, and when I asked Mom if she remembered it, she told me the past is better left there. My sister Penny was always afraid of the upstairs at our house. She never went up there at night. Our main conversation every night went something like this. "Buffy, go upstairs and find me a white sweater, black jeans and leather jacket." The clothing items would change from night to night, but I always asked her to get her things, but she would not go up without an adult after dark. "Why can't you go get them?" "Because something is up there." "I sleep up there, nothing's happened to me." "Just wait, someday it will." Okay, I will admit it is creepy up there. I will give you the layout. There are two rooms that lead into each other, no hallway, and there is an attic above and one on each side. The house is well over 100 years old, and there is a banister over the stairs, but it is closed off by a door. I remember Penny coming home from dates, and before she would take her boyfriend upstairs, she would send him up with a flashlight to check the closets and under the beds, even though I was in one of those beds. Once, when our mother asked her why she would not sleep upstairs in her room, she rattled off numerous reasons. You can see small lights come out of the closet, and you can hear footsteps and heavy breathing in the attic, and there is always a sense of being watched a little too closely. I would respond, "That's ridiculous. I had never seen or heard anything." My mom would say, "She's okay. She can sleep wherever she wants. She's not hurting anything." I think my mom knew, but since nothing was bothering me at the time, she overlooked it. Better to have one daughter on the couch than two. I even took this problem to my dad, being as he was always on my side, and mom seemed that she was always on Penny's side. Eventually, my sister got married and moved out when she was 18 and I was 11. Then I guess the ghost or whatever thought it was my turn, and this is my experience. In the attic, I would hear stomping. And it was not just one attic, it was all three spaces. There were whispers in the closet like two children having a conversation. The conversation I overheard were from talking about dolls, sometimes they were trying to figure out what happened to someone named Uncle Daffy, and sometimes it sounded as if though they were discussing how they could run away. I did not get a bad feeling from the girls in the closet. I was always being watched all day and all night and lived in a constant state of panic. When I was upstairs, every nerve was on edge. The worst thing was this big black shadow in the middle of the night was asking where Penny was. The voice wasn't the voice of a kid. It sounded like it came from someone who smoked 4 packs a day for 50 years. The black shadow asked my sister 6 times every night. When I would not answer out of fear, the shadow would throw things at me. Books, figurines, even pictures. Then it was my turn to sleep on the couch, and then I understood my sister. It wasn't an excuse, she actually heard those things. I never understood why I didn't until after Penny moved out and I was bullied by this ghost, or whatever it was. That's what this entity was. A bully, something that always had to have power over us, the young powerless sisters that lived in the home. Fast forward 2 years, after Penny was gone, she had her own home. My oldest sister Jeannie couldn't afford the house she was renting due to being in the middle of a divorce, brought her 3 kids and moved in with us. Jennifer, which was 5, Kevin, who was 3, and Amanda, who was 2, which meant Jennifer would be staying with me and we were both expected to sleep upstairs. We were woken up all the time by stomping, and when Jennifer would start to cry from being scared, I would tell her it was because the house is old and that's what old homes did. They settled at night. Exactly what my mom always told me when I heard odd noises in our home. Jennifer's 6th birthday rolls around and my mother buys her one of those creepy clown dolls, you know, the ones with a plastic head, a wire body under its clown clothes, and has the most insanely evil laugh. That clown was always going off by itself at night, never during the day. One night I decided that I had had enough, so I got out of bed and went over to take the batteries out, but when I opened the battery pack, no batteries were inside. I told my mom and older sister, but no one cared, or they thought it was an overactive imagination. Penny believed me. So the next day I got up and threw it in the attic, but it would still go off in the middle of the night. Then one day I came home and the doll was out of the attic and sitting on the chair across from my bed. When I asked who put it there, no one knew. We ended up burning that doll. Penny came and burned sage in our home. Now that I'm grown up, my kids, who like to stay with my mom, always tell me about their things being moved and their chargers being jerked from the wall. But I still feel that it waits to this day for Penny to come home. Maybe because she feared it the most, I don't know. But I know that that bully brought me a lot closer to the sister whom I couldn't possibly live without now. This is a true story that happened several years back when I was 13. This was a time when I was growing up in New York. We actually had a summer house on Cape Cod and spent every other weekend there, if we could. Cape Cod is a peninsula off the east coast of Massachusetts. It becomes very busy, even crowded during the summertime, but during the winter season it becomes empty. The majority of houses in our area are owned as summer houses, so during the winter, The houses are still there, but the people are not there. In contrast to New York, there are only street lamps on the single main road in this town. The main road goes from the town center to the beach. Aside from this road, all the others are dark and very black at night. Also, Cape Cod extends out into the Atlantic from the mainland, forming a bay, Cape Cod Bay. Not only can one watch the sunrise over the Atlantic Ocean, but they can also watch the sunset over Cape Cod Bay on any given clear day. Another effect of being surrounded by ocean is that there is very little man-made light at night. The stars are so clear that the Milky Way is clearly visible spanning across the sky on clear nights. This story happened during the vacation period between Christmas and the New Year. The Christmas celebrations were finished. There were plenty of leftover turkey and pumpkin pie. We got a bit of cabin fever with all the Christmas food and family on one evening. My older sister, who is 7 years older than I, 20 at the time, came up with an idea to take a walk to the harbor, which was about a 20-minute walk from our house. The harbor can be fun because we can walk out onto the docks and walk among the boats. While I was a bit creeped out to walk around a deserted beach town on a cold winter night, I also thought it would be fun to get out of the house and maybe even a bit exciting. We headed out. Across the street from our classic Cape Cod cottage is a field with a forest at the other end. At nighttime, I would also have a little fear that there would be a psycho watching from the tall grass. Perhaps he would have an axe. But while it kept my nerves wary, I knew it was my imagination. But still, icy wind blowing on tall grass is a perfect setting for some horrors. Add to this a moonless sky with a million sparkling stars and the Milky Way above, and the horror setting is at level with Stephen King. We walked out into the main road, went a bit down the road, and then turned to walk down a side street that leads to the street that dips downhill toward the harbor. This side street runs along the backside of a long hotel. It's more like a two-level motel, painted light yellow, that has a pool. It is well situated in town, so it can be full of life during the summer. On this December evening, the hotel was closed for the season, completely dark, and several windows are covered with plywood for protection. My sister mentioned that a hotel that spans an entire block but is partially boarded reminds her of a horror movie. Like one of these slasher films where the characters make all the wrong decisions and walk in the worst of dark places just to find their worst nightmare come true. At the end of the street with the hotel, we continue to the left, which is a long road downhill through the woods to the harbor. This isn't a pure forest because there are houses set back from the road with an occasional driveway. Many of the driveways have reflectors on a rock, a fence, or just standing on a metal stick. These reflectors reflect back the headlights from cars. I mention this because we could not see any of them or anything. It was pitch black in the wooded area and the road seemed to continue into the black. Come to think of it, we had not seen a single car or a single person or a single sign of life since we left our house. My nerves were on edge. I was only 13 at the time, and although my nerves were screaming, I tried to stay calm because I wanted to seem tough to my sister. The woods alongside the road were particularly nerve-wracking. The trees come right up to the asphalt on each side of the road. They provide many opportunities to hide someone or something. The houses beyond the woods were dark, because rarely did vacationers come here in winter. I started to notice that my sister was also starting to lose her nerves, and that's when I felt it. I felt a flush of energy move up the back of my neck. It makes it feel like the hairs are sticking out on end. This is a feeling I get when I'm being watched. It's hard to describe this feeling, but I still get it today, sometimes when someone is looking at me from behind. It's either some kind of sixth sense or it's just my imagination working with my intuition. We were now midway into the wooded area, down the hill towards the harbor. I was sort of starting to lose it and was just about to stop pretending not to be freaked out and tell my sister, "Let's go back," when she suggested it. She said, "It's late. Maybe we don't have to go all the way to the harbor." I replied back, "Yeah, plus it's kind of creepy and dark down there." The back of my neck was shivering and I felt my body shudder as it wrestled between acting relaxed and flipping the switch to fight or flight mode. My sister replied, "Yeah, pretty creepy. Come on, let's go back to the house and we can see the harbor tomorrow." We turned around and she grabbed my hand and we started walking fast back up the hill. I remember that she held my hand so tight it hurt, and my sister never holds my hand. I can't think of another time she did this, and this is where the story takes a deep dive down the rabbit hole. As we got towards the end of the wooded area, my sister screamed out, "I've got a knife and I'm not afraid to use it!" And she did not lose any rhythm of her fast walk while saying this. We crossed the street and headed onto the street with the back side of the closed two-level motel. My sister continues speed walking and looks back. She let out a little panic noise and looked back again. She then commanded me to not look back. I was utterly freaking out at this point. Aside from the eerie vibe of the dark, empty street and my own inner panic, I had not actually seen anything out of the ordinary, with the exception of my sister's completely and now suddenly insane behavior. Then she said, "When I say run, you run, okay?" "Okay." We were almost at the main road, a block from our street, and she screams, "Run." We book it. She let go of my hand and both broke into the best sprint we could do. I could hear our footsteps banging the asphalt and could also hear several other steps banging in the distance. We cut across the grass area to a shortcut towards our street and ran through the front yards of our neighbor's house to make a beeline for the front door of our house. We made it. We both ran in and locked the storm door, which is mostly glass. I was panicking, but not sure if there was anything or if we were just going crazy. It was a strange transition from outside, which was terrifying, to inside the warm lit house, which seemed safe. I was questioning what happened in my mind. I could sense that my sister was also questioning herself whether there even was a threat, or we both just lost our minds out there. I asked my sister what she saw, and she said that there was a man that was standing at the edge of one of the driveways. We walked right by him on the way back. She said that when we were behind the hotel, he crossed the street and was following us for a while. She said he was looking right at us, and although we were walking very fast, he was gaining on us. She explained that it doesn't make sense that a man would be standing out there in that dark, wooded area. Honestly, I really don't understand what happened that night, and I'm not sure how much of what my sister said is true, if she was seeing things or not. But one thing is for sure, I realized that I prefer walking to that harbor during the daylight. For most of my childhood, my family and I lived one house away from a creep. For the sake of the story, I'll call him Mr. Stan. Our old neighborhood started at the top of a hill and went down to a small lake where the road turned right and branched off into a cul-de-sac and another residential road. Mr. Stan's house was at the top of the hill and ours was in the middle. Mr. Stan lived in the neighborhood long before we moved in. It's hard for me to remember any vivid details about him as I was very young at the time, but what I do remember is that every time he saw us, his face would scrunch up as if though he smelled something terrible. There was one house between his place and ours, something I'm very grateful for. I don't know what life would be like if we had to live right next to him. Right from when we were little, my parents were very strict about walking past Mr. Stan's house. They told us that Mr. Stan was sick in the head, and if he ever asked us to come into his house, we were to never, ever, ever be allowed to do so by ourselves. For years, no one told us exactly why Mr. Stan was bad, but we didn't need details. We just knew to avoid him. The look he gave us whenever he was working on his car or planting flowers in his garden was enough. When my sister and I would walk up the hill to school, we would cross the street when he got to his place just to be safe. Like I said, I don't remember very much about Mr. Stan, and his twisted story begins long before I was even born. For this, I turned to my mom to fill in the details. My mom said that before we ever moved into the cul-de-sac around the late 70s and early 80s, Mr. Stan already had the reputation of being a heavy drinker. He would get drunk and go over to the house of the family right across the street from us to do terrible things to the daughter while she was babysitting. The daughter tried to tell her mother about it, but since she was a rebellious child, her mother didn't believe her. Her family and Mr. Stan's family were actually good friends. Mr. Stan worked as a corrections officer, and soon accusations surfaced that Mr. Stan and another officer regularly would do terrible things to their co-workers' kids. Mr. Stan was able to avoid conviction by ratting out the other officer, but in the process he lost his job. As far as I know, he never really worked after that. Mr. Stan had two daughters of his own, and while the older one claimed she was touched and suffered from mental problems as a result, the younger one said she was never mistreated in any way and grew up to be a very positive person. Mr. Stan's wife stood by her husband and claimed he was innocent throughout the whole ordeal. Ironically, the older daughter's emotional instability resulted in her children going to live with Grandpa. More on that in a moment. When my family moved into our house in the cul-de-sac, our next-door neighbor, a kind but nosy old man, told my dad to keep my sister and I away from Stan. He told my parents the gossip and Mr. Stan's history with children, which understandably horrified them both. As a result, my mom and dad were wary of him from the start. Mr. Stan was cordial enough, and he would wave hello to my family and all that neighborly stuff. According to Mum, he even offered to babysit my little sister and I, to which my parents, politically but emphatically, declined. Then, sometime around 2002, my dad was going to work when he came across a neighborhood kid, let's call her Lana, on her way up the street. My dad is a chatty person, and so he asked Lana what she was up to. Lana told him that she was going to Mr. Stan's house to give him a back rub. Dad knew that something was off, and so he told Lana's parents. To his surprise, they weren't alarmed at all and said that sort of thing happened all the time. According to Mum, when Lana was older, Dad asked her if Mr. Stan ever acted inappropriately toward her during those visits, and her answer was, definitely. When my sister was in kindergarten and I was in grade 3, Mr. Stan's grandkids came to live with him and his wife for reasons I mentioned earlier. My parents couldn't believe this was allowed by anyone, especially considering the allegations and neighborhood gossip around Mr. Stan. His granddaughter was in the same kindergarten class as my sister, and his grandson was about my age. Mum told me that it was so disturbing to see the sweet little granddaughter at school every day and know what was probably going on behind closed doors. My parents have always had strong morals, particularly my dad. They would often talk about what they should do. They wanted to report Mr. Stan to the authorities before any harm could come to his grandchildren. Mum and Dad knew that if they reported Mr. Stan, they would be putting themselves at risk, and the rest of the neighborhood was no help. Mum said it was as if they were all hiding under rocks and turning a blind eye to what was happening. In the end, my parents' strong morality won out, and they decided, with the risk of being exposed as whistleblowers, to report Mr. Stan to the principal at my elementary school. The principal, in turn, called the ministry, who sent people to Mr. Stan's house for home visits and investigations. In the end, it was decided that the grandchildren would be removed from Mr. Stan's house. Mum isn't sure how it happened, but somehow it was leaked that my parents were the ones who reported Mr. Stan. She thinks Lana's family may have had a hand in it, and as Mum put it, that's when the real fun began. Mr. Stan was no longer friendly toward my family. No more waves, no more chit-chat. Instead, he would target my mom with his car if she was walking down the road alone, or scream obscenities at my dad as he went to work. A few times he crossed the center line to scare us if we passed each other while driving. He told my dad that he ruined his life and that he was a horrible person. Thinking about that now really boils my blood because my dad is one of the kindest and most considerate men I know. Mum was miserable and wanted to move, but Dad, as unshakable as he is, said he wasn't in a hurry. Mum told me it took 3 years of house hunting before she finally convinced Dad it was time to go. Only after all of this, when we had been living in our beautiful new home out in the country, did I finally start to uncover the details of the story, but sadly, it doesn't end there. After we moved out of the cul-de-sac, Lana and other girls, who were now grown up, came forward to report Mr. Stan and what he had done. He was hauled into court for a second time, and this time there was no one he could rat on to save himself. The testimony against him was building up. My parents followed the trial in the newspaper. They wanted to see him put away for all of the terrible things he'd done. I have no memory of these proceedings, of course, and nobody wanted to explain it to me. I don't blame them. Mr. Stan was not only a former corrections officer, but now he was also convicted. He knew he would not last long if he went to prison. So, on a quiet morning 1 week before his sentencing, Mr. Stan took a hunting rifle and shot himself. The folks who moved into Lana's house after her family left were walking their kids to school when they heard the shot. Mom tells me the image of that scene haunts her to this day. I think she imagines it would have been like that if it were her walking my sister and I to go to school in place of that other family. Or maybe she was disturbed to learn that Mr. Stan had a gun. I know it sounds harsh, but I'm glad he's gone. He could never hurt another child again. My memories of this whole ordeal are far less interesting than the actual event, but one thing I do remember very clearly is being afraid of Mr. Stan's house. I knew it was dangerous. In my memory, it was painted black with white stucco. The car park and stairs to the front door were all underneath the wood roof, which cast the entire front of the house into shadow. To me, it was a monster's house, though I didn't know why. My sister and I only ever went to Mr. Stan's front door once. It was Halloween, and my parents decided it was okay for us to trick-or-treat at his house, since they would be standing at the bottom of the stairs. I was actually very reluctant to go, and my parents had to encourage me that it was okay. Mr. Stan's house was the only one that didn't need Halloween decorations to be scary, so my sister and I cautiously climbed the stairs and rang the doorbell. Mr. Stan's wife opened the door. She was kind to us and gave us candy, and I remember being surprised that Mr. Stan's wife was so nice. But what I remember most was that I wanted to see inside the forbidden house. For some reason, this has still stuck with me. I looked behind Mrs. Stan, and there was Mr. Stan in a wife beater top, beer belly and all, sitting in an armchair watching TV. It was dim in the living room except for a lamp and the glow of the TV. Mr. Stan didn't look at us. For years, I wondered if that was what bad men look like. When I think about this story now, 11 years later, it really hits me how dark my neighborhood was under the surface. It's quite disturbing to me because my childhood was actually quite happy. I was too young to notice anything wrong. I couldn't sense the tension that my parents lived with every day. I didn't know how much potential danger my sister and I were in. All I knew was that it was a beautiful day to play with my marbles and go to the lake. But now that I think of it, Mr. Stan may have been the reason that my parents bought a copy of You Can Say No, a picture book that teaches children about safety around bad people. I think my parents handled the situation very well, and I am so thankful they were attentive and brave during the whole thing. This story could have gone very differently. When I think about our old house on the cul-de-sac, it's usually the happy memories I think of first. Mom tells me that despite all of the trouble they went through, neither she or Dad regret the decisions they made, and she left me with one last ominous message. They say that every neighborhood has a monster living there. Most of the time, we just don't know it.